Hello out there on the internet. I am Matthew Gault, and this is Cyber Look. I'm sorry, we have to talk about crypto again. Wait, don't leave. I know, stick around. The story is really funny and weird, I promise. You heard about this guy, Sam Bankman-Fried, and FTX? FTX was the second largest cryptocurrency exchange in the world, and Bankman-Fried was the guy who ran it. He was a young genius, people said. He practiced something called effective altruism, gave away money to people on the street. He was a League of Legends addict, and he was predicted to be the world's first trillionaire. Well, that's all up in smoke. He's bankrupt now, FTX is in ruins, large amounts of crypto seem to keep shifting around, and no one is quite sure where Bankman-Fried is. There were reports that he was in Argentina. He has denied that. He told Reuters that he was in the Bahamas. But who is this guy? Why did everyone think he was a genius? And how did FTX seemingly make billions of dollars in wealth overnight just evaporate? Well, here with me today to answer those questions is Edward Anguiso Jr. Sir, thank you so much for once again coming onto the show to talk about the disastrous sci-fi present that we all live in.
Yeah, thanks for having me on to talk about this. It is fun. You know, there's a lot of schadenfreude, however you say that word. There's a lot of it to go around lately, which is always fun.
Yeah, this guy in particular, it was funny because I didn't really know anything about him because I think a lot of us have kind of turned our brains off to crypto in the past 6 months. Yeah. After those last couple big crashes and like NFTs finally stopped kind of panning out for people, our brain shut down. We didn't want to hear about it anymore. But this one was so big, and the guy at the center of it is so funny. Because people had spent so much time building him up. Is this crypto crash any different materially than any of the other ones?
I think that there's space to argue that it is, right? You know, some of the people I've been reading about this, specifically over at Bloomberg, Matt Levine and Joe Weisenthal, have made, I think, a good point, an argument in saying, look, like, you know, what we're looking at with the balance sheets of this company that were just, like, you know, lacking really real assets to trade and had massive holes and were probably were trading, it seems like, on, you know, near insolvency, which is legal, of course. I mean, so much of what was going on is illegal, but that doesn't stop them. That there's not only going to be a crackdown that comes on FTX and the people associated with it, but also that there will be a liquidity crunch that will probably compromise a lot of projects, exchanges, protocols, and that there will likely be kind of, you know, that this might mark the beginning of the end of consumer interest and institutional interest in crypto, right? Because you had someone who was interfacing with regulators, lobbying, advocating, doing all the things you're supposed to be doing, offering a pretty sophisticated, it seemed, product and exchange, and also engaged in a serious amount of fraud that threatened the entire market, you know. You know, as more details emerge, I think it's really each new detail is more surprising than the last, in that, like, you just don't, I wouldn't have expected him to have been this stupid or this reckless or this fraudulent with a lot of people's money, given how big he was, right? I expect a base level of it, you know, to get to that size. But I think that also comes with maybe people overestimating how or anticipating or believing that, you know, people would wisen up and not engage in this sort of, you know, shenanigans once they get to a certain size.
So, yeah, this was the guy that was supposed to make all of this legitimate, right? This was the guy that was supposed to be the savior of crypto and was going to make it mainstream and was going to do it in a way that was going to be responsible. And then everything fell apart. So let's back way up, if we can. What is FTX, and what was Bankman-Fried's pitch, and then how did it all fall apart?
Yeah, I mean, so FTX is basically a crypto exchange where you would, you know, the premise was you basically are able to take a dollar and do anything you want with it. You know, in a pitch to Sequoia Capital, which put $210 million, I believe, into his company, the pitch was, you know, I want you to be able to take your dollar and buy crypto, buy a banana, buy onion futures contract, whatever it is that you want. And on FTX, you can also buy more sophisticated or complex crypto related assets. You know, there, you can do some derivatives contracts, you can do some weird bets and gambling if you don't want to be directly exposed to crypto. So the idea was it's supposed to be a platform for traders, for people who really want to trade crypto and want to speculate on it and want to make money on it and want to do all sorts of trades that might not be possible in other markets because they're not as willing to offer them, offer, you know, one contract or another or one asset or another. And so, you know, for this, he grew. It was the third largest exchange until sometime this year when it surpassed Coinbase and became the second largest exchange. It allowed people to deposit funds. It offered its own native token. It offered credit facilities, loans, effectively to other crypto exchanges, platforms, protocols. I mean, all of this made it seem like this was a pillar of the ecosystem in the industry, that it would be here to stay, that it would be spearheading efforts to introduce regulations, because it had good relationships with people at the CFTC and the SEC, because it just hired a former FTC commissioner and chair. But I think all of this collapsed really because, you know, there was a good investigation by the Financial Times that came out like a little bit after my piece had come out that talked about how they got the balance sheet. And this is a company where I think $12 billion of customer, you know, $13 billion of customer deposits were supposed to be. And they had loaned out most of that, you know, billions of it to Omida Research, which was a hedge fund that was run by a co-founder, former partner of Sam Bankman-Fried. They were loaning that money to Omida so they could bankroll really risky, high risk, high reward plays and on crypto assets, and had lost billions of dollars, and weren't able to give the customers back their money. And this was complicated also further by the fact that they had let customers borrow assets and you know, things that they might otherwise be able to offer to other people. They let them borrow them and post up FTX's own native token as collateral. So the native token was held by these people. They artificially pumped up the value. They said that it was, you know, backed by all of these assets effectively. But in reality, there was nothing behind it. And when Binance's head, CZ, Changpeng Zhao, found out, or, you know, he basically dumped it or tried to dump it. And then they said, oh, we don't actually have enough, you know, liquidity to allow you to cash out, which caused a bank run, you know, where people were basically trying to withdraw out of the platform, trying to dump their own positions in the native token, and collapse the value of it, and then force the company effectively to freeze withdrawals, try to lie, you know, and say that they weren't intentionally trading customer assets, but that they were mislabeling them accidentally, and then learn, as you know, as we did in later reporting, that he had created backdoors to siphon money, the customer assets, intentionally to Omida Research, so that he could fund the trades without setting off red alarms, red flags, and alarm bells. Right. So this is someone who, you know, came into crypto, probably had a grand idea of creating like a platform, got caught up in really risky trades because, as they've said before, they have a very, very low risk aversion. I think that's the right way to phrase it. In that, like, they had a high tolerance for risk, and were engaged in all these plays, as was Caroline, their former partner and the head of Omida Research. They were engaged in these plays that basically lost a lot of the money. They didn't have enough money. They called around for loans. Word got out. People dumped or tried to dump FTF, which is the native token. And it entered into a debt spiral and eventually filed for bankruptcy.
So it sounds like, and correct me if I'm wrong here, he was just borrowing money and then shifting things around constantly as like the money slowly leaked out of the system or quickly leaked out of the system and kind of hiding it as he went.
Yeah, you might say it had a triangle shape to it, you know, where, where he's taking money out from one level to provide liquidity for another level and convincing them to offer up, or convincing another level to offer up liquidity that can then be provided to another level, and then siphoning chunks at each step into another company that also had a little bit of a triangle structure to it. And its payments and its liquidity. So I think this, you know, it's fun to look at because this is, I think that no one anticipated the level of it, right? No one anticipated that there was a $10 billion hole in the balance sheets. No one anticipated that there will likely, it seems that they might have made off with, you know, upwards of $1 billion, but that, you know, we're not sure about that because we're still looking at the books and they've just filed bankruptcy proceedings and we just got the documents today. There was also a hack that was supposed to have happened at one point in the night that disappeared a few hundred million dollars and that they were confused about and told conflicting stories about. You know, so there's a lot of weird
shifts of all this like ancient crypto, ancient Bitcoin, things that haven't moved in a decade, like suddenly changing wallets, a lot of really bizarre stuff, right?
Yeah, I think it's a coincidence when you tell people that your exchange is fine, and then the next day you file for bankruptcy after freezing withdrawals, and then you get hacked maybe 24 hours later. And people also don't know where you are in the world. And you are sending out cryptic tweets and deleting other tweets. And you are also giving nonsensical interviews to the New York Times and being, you know, obtuse in text messages with reporters. All of that is a coincidence. I don't think, you know, that could be anything. You know, that doesn't mean he's stealing the money. That doesn't mean there was fraud here, of course.
I mean, things look weird, but we have to put the words alleged around a lot of this. You know, we will learn.
Allegedly $10 billion went into a hole and didn't come back out. And allegedly he got hacked around the same time that these revelations came out. And allegedly he's in the Bahamas, but also allegedly no one has seen him. And, you know, there's a lot of weird things. I mean, here's one thing that I think was a fun little detail that also got lost. So there was a, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried got, you know, his start as a trader, right? And he talked about a really kind of smart way in which he made a lot of money, which was he noticed that in certain markets, Bitcoin traded at a premium. And you could take advantage of that if you convinced someone in that country to open up an account for you to trade with. And then you paid them either a part of the profit on the spread, or if you paid them just like a flat fee, whatever it is, you pay someone to let you open up an account in their name and trade in it, and made millions of dollars doing that. This week, FTX said that Bahama regulators told them that while they had to freeze assets and withdrawals for everyone, they were allowing people in the Bahamas to take out withdrawals. That ended up most likely creating a black market where people would entice or encourage people in the Bahamas to try and open up an account for them so they could facilitate transfers and trades out and withdrawals out of the exchange. Right.
The Bahamas, we should say, this is where FTX is incorporated, correct? That's where the head is?
FTX used to be in Hong Kong and it was moved to the Bahamas, which is also becoming an important point because regulators are looking at whether or not they even have the authority to go after FTX since it is based in the Bahamas. You know, but also I think like the reasons why the Bahamas are attractive, you know, because of lax financial regulations, there are three laws and he broke all of them. You know, there are, in terms of what you're supposed to do with money and securities fraud and trading, are also the things that might end up tying the noose around him in the sense that the fraud feels a little bit more flagrant. And, you know, if authorities there decide to go after him, they have cause to do so. But it's still also developing and turning out, right? I have no idea what is going to happen in the short term. You know, part of me feels like he will be hit with the hammer by regulators. But also the other fact of the matter is, like, you know, countless other platforms have gone bankrupt just this past few months, right? Block or have, you know, revealed that they were insolvent or frozen withdrawals and revealed that there was fraud going on. You know, we had Voyager, we had Three Arrows Capital, 3AC, we had, you know, BlockFi, we might have Crypto.com. You know, all of these places have done fraud. We had Celsius. It's not even clear in those instances what's going to happen to those people and if they're ever going to be held accountable. Not to mention, you know, this sort of thing, when it happens in the financial system, what usually happens is a settlement or a fine and a ban from lifetime trading instead of, you know, jail time or instead of like really punitive damages to make it all.
Let me just float this. Whose money did he lose?
Everyone
and,
else.
And are any of those people scary?
Yeah, so I think that's a good question. FTX was able to court more successfully than most celebrities, you know, public figures, huge investors in venture capital firms, Binance, another exchange. So I would say that a lot of the people who traded on it, or there are a lot of people who traded on it and had millions of dollars locked up, tens of millions. There are big question marks around some of the bigger investors, like, you know, Tom Brady and his ex-wife, who were, you know, front men and are rumored to have put in a significant amount of their life savings or net worth into the company. And now it's bankrupt and gone to zero. So I think that, you know, going also back to the Bahamas, like, you know, one of the reasons why it's attractive is also probably the reason why it would be scary, right? I mean, these places where people choose to set up because of lax financial regulations are also places where other people set up because of lax financial regulations, right? And if, you know, we have no idea about who else was invested in there yet, but I can imagine a scenario where it gets scary because he lost money from people he shouldn't have lost money from. But for now, I think the main fear is the government, right? The government is loudly proclaiming that, you know, it's going to investigate him. The DOJ, California, other states are investigating or looking into if they can investigate him. That is where I think like the first wave of fear probably is.
Well, yeah, he lost. It wasn't just like anonymous crypto whales this time. It was celebs, right?
Yeah.
You can't mess with the American celebs.
Yeah, you can. I mean, you can, like, regulators will rouse awake if you lose billions of dollars of consumer funds, right? And then start, you know, going after small fry. But losing, like you said, public figures, burning politicians who were involved with you or who you were fundraising for and doing dinners with, like with Kristen Gillibrand, and then revealing yourself to be a giant fraud. I mean, like, I think that some of these things where people have egg on their face are going to motivate retaliation and a crackdown or help motivate it in a way that we didn't see with other platforms also.
And then your immediate response is to go onto Twitter and say, I'm sorry, that's the biggest thing. I fucked up and should have done better. Like, buddy, maybe don't tweet.
You know, he not only should he not be tweeting, he did like a really long interview with the New York Times. I think like me personally, if I was his lawyer, you know, I would sock him for talking to the press like this. He's someone who's kind of shirked at PR, you know, from what I can tell, what I know, he's been talking to journalists and just reaching out to them over the past year. Right. This is also part of the reason why he was able to do the profiles. I think a lot of people, understandably so, are hesitant or reticent to reach out to media, anticipating that it'll be a crypto skeptical article. And he was probably one of the only operators in this space who was savvy enough to bring people in and somehow woo them. Even though there's not much there to be impressed by, they were still impressed by. I mean, you had people saying that he lived like a monk, but he has like at least two penthouses, one in the Bahamas and one in upstate New York. You know, this is a man who has a private jet. This is a man who's a billionaire. He does not live like a monk, you know. You had people who would listen to him kind of ramble about utilitarianism and say, wow, this is a philosopher king. You know, this is someone who's thinking about things above our mortal coil. So I think there's a lot of stuff there. Like, there are failures to cover him and see him for what he was in the moment. And that comes from people who are not, you know, who are maybe not critical enough about crypto, not critical enough about effective altruism in the modern form, modern day iteration. And also people who might be taken in by how quickly he got rich instead of asking, you know, the flip side of that question is, why did you get so rich? You know, he became a billionaire in little than under 20 months, right? That's interesting. Why did that happen? I think it was just, you know, there are failures on there, but that's not to say that the media is responsible for, like, you know, this thing falling apart. It fell apart because of him.
Right. Yeah, ultimately, he's responsible. All right, we're going to pause there for a break, cyber listeners. We are talking about Sam Bankman-Fried and the collapse of FTX. We will be back right after these messages from our sponsors. If you're watching the live stream on Twitch or YouTube, there are no ads. All right.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Cyber listeners, welcome back. You were I am Matthew Galt. I'm talking with Edward Anguiso Jr. We're talking about Sam Bankman-Fried and FTX. All right, I want to get a little bit more into kind of the mystique that was built around him. Yeah. Because I think that's a huge part of the story and a huge part of kind of how he was able to build this thing. Because he sold himself as much as he sold crypto, right? People called him a savior and a genius. And some of the people that invested in him said that he was going to be the world's first trillionaire. Where did this guy come from and how did he get started?
Yeah, he's this, you know, 30-year-old wonder kid from MIT. Parents are Stanford law professors. He got his start as a trader at Jane Street. Moved on to working for a charity group, the Center for Effective Altruism. Left that and started working on FTX, right? I think there are a few parts that are interesting and probably build, you know, the mystique. Part of it is the effective altruism. Effective altruism in of itself is this philosophy that kind of asks, you know, what is the way to make altruism more effectively? Like, how can we look at outcomes and maximize them? And so the first iteration comes from this philosopher, Peter Singer, and he talks about how, you know, one way to do this is by looking at charities and saying, okay, you know, I can either donate money to eye surgeries in a certain region or bed nets in another region. And, you know, which one is going to have a larger quality of life improvement and which one is going to be facilitated by an organization that has better operations. And then that's, and we should do, you know, calculations like this to try to quantify where the most impact can be had. And sometimes it gets a little silly where they invent this unit that kind of was supposed to represent quality of life improvements as some sort of quantified metric. And you say, oh, well, you know, this one has 5 units and this one has 10 units. So I'll do the 10 unit one. But that's basically the first wave of effective altruism. You know, donate more of your income, live a little bit less, you know, frivolously, maybe like a Jesuit, and spend that money where it would actually help, which is, you know, improving lives of people in the global South. Then comes the second wave, of which Sam Bankman Fried is a large funder of and a big advocate of himself, which is that what really matters is effectively allocating resources to reduce the risk of humanity's extinction so that in the far-flung future, as many as possible humans are alive, living unimaginably pleasurable lives in electronic nirvana, or in post-scarcity or whatever have you, right? The more people we can save today would help do that. But the best way to save people today is not through global health initiatives, global poverty relief, undermining inequality, you know, fixing political and social problems in the immediate sense, addressing climate change, so on and so forth. The best way to do that is to ensure artificial intelligence doesn't run amok. It's to figure out if we can stop an asteroid. It's to figure out if we can, if we're properly prepared for a pandemic, right? These are the things that yield the most returns. And so it ends up being a vehicle for, or has become a vehicle for Silicon Valley, you know, people to kind of rationalize today's inequalities, you know, and structural advantages that they enjoy. And kick down the ladder, right? And say, well, you know, not like we're up here and we're just gonna, you know, we happen to be in the best place possible to help steer things so that everyone in the far-flung future is better off, which already conforms with the philosophy that they have. I think part of the mystique is people kind of reading the wrong or gleaning the wrong lessons or not asking the right questions about effective altruism, because it may be, you know, hear a discussion about AGI and the risk of AGI, or hearing a discussion about pandemics and thinking about, you know, how is this person, you know, how does this person see the world? How does this person think about utility? How is this person rationalizing the money that they give or advice that they're giving to other people to go into certain fields to maximize the money that they can give? Instead of asking, you know, what's the underlying ideology at play there, which, you know, for long-termism, which is what this is called, it's a sort of cynicism that makes sense when you look at someone like Sam Bankman-Fried in crypto, right? That sort of cynicism allows you to rationalize saying, I'm involved in, you know, crypto, which hurts a lot of people, might scam a lot of people, might do some harm in the immediate sense, but will give me enough money to do more good in the long-term sense, right? And it's okay to be a little unethical now because we're doing the real ethical thing, which is helping 10 to the 73 trillion human beings live in nirvana bliss on Jupiter's moon or something.
It's auctioning off the present to pay for a Star Trek future that's probably not going to come.
Right, you know? It's utilitarianism in this sense is like, it's a really mundane, I can't even remember the quote, but it's someone, you know, said something like the mundane quote, but it's a mundane philosophy, but it's one where it's pretty easy to justify, you know, soaking hands in blood, as is the case with this, right? Maybe not with crypto in the sense that people are not going, you're not going to be blood soaked, but you're going to be ruining people's lives and destroying their savings, their livelihoods, making them, you know, addicted to gambling, you know, ruining families, destroying pension funds and institutional funds, just so that you can shave half a percentage point off extinction risk, in their own parlance, right?
And extinction risk according to who?
That's also the other thing, right? Yeah, I mean, their objectives and their agenda is usually one that happens to dovetail with already pre-existing dystopian ideas about human nature and about the threats that we're facing that come from, you know, that corner of Silicon Valley that didn't read their favorite sci-fi books closely enough, right? So I think that this is an important thing that gets left out. Like, that's the intellectual scaffolding that I think, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried operates off, right? We can talk about whether or not that means he's walking around, you know, thinking evil thoughts, but I think that does make him a very cynical person, right? Because he's concerned about this long-term vision and has said that the short-term stuff doesn't really matter. And then the second part of the mystique, I think, also just comes from crypto. Like, I think there is, you know, there were a few things that were going on. Sam Bankman-Fried got rich very quickly off of crypto, and he was offering an exchange. It didn't seem like he was offering something we could easily mock, right? Like an asset or some sort of, you know, security, ugly picture, ridiculous NFT or a ridiculous asset put on top of things. But, he still kind of was with the native token, right? There was less of a critique. There was less of an interest in looking at crypto and of itself as like something that maybe that shouldn't exist. And more so just, this guy's made an interesting place for crypto to be traded. And he's gotten really rich off of it. And he says he wants to give away his fortune, right? And that sequence of rationales offered by him are interesting. And we should look at that. instead of asking, what does like a cynical utilitarian, what are they going to do in a crypto ecosystem? Well, they're probably going to do some fraud so that they can achieve what they think is the greater good, right? Which is, if you think that the greater good by far is ensuring that trillions more humans exist in 2000 years, you're probably going to do some fraud.
Why are there so many pictures of him asleep in a beanbag?
Oh, he's a gamer. That's why. I mean, he sleeps in the office. He says he does it so he doesn't have to reset because he stays in work mode. Mm. But also because he games from those chairs, from what I remember. He talked about how he likes to game during phone calls, plays League of Legends. Is not that good at it, but, plays it religiously. Well,
all right. I just looked into the League of Legends thing. And it's basically unknowable how good he is.
All right. Yeah, I'll give him that. Okay. I would say he doesn't have the best, for someone who it comes up as much in his profiles, I would expect him to have a higher ranking and a higher win rate. Right.
Right. Let me go off on a tangent here. Yeah. I think, have you ever played League of Legends? Do you know anybody that plays League of Legends? I'm sorry for anyone that plays League of Legends and listens to this podcast, but I lived with a guy for a very long time that played League of Legends. And that game, poison, straight poison into your body. It is. it made him a monster, and or he was already maybe a monster. It brought out his worst qualities.
Yeah.
And it would be stuff where, like, I have to wake up at 5 a.m. for a shift somewhere I don't want to be the next day. And it's 2 a.m. and he's still up and is yelling at the video game loudly enough that I can't, like, even my doors are closed. I've got earplugs in. I can still hear him yelling at the game. And he's downstairs. So I just, like, anytime I know anyone's like a real big League of Legends head, I'm like, something's off. Something's off.
I mean, yeah, that should be a red flag. I think it should be a red flag where if you're very big head and you're playing it during calls where you're supposed to be convincing people to give you hundreds of millions of dollars.
It's a game that requires like concentration in the moment. You can't be watching a YouTube video or chilling out or doing anything else while you're in league. Yeah. You have to be paying attention.
Yeah.
And part of this guy's origin story, Bankman-Fried's origin story, is he's on the phone with Sequoia Capital, right? And they're about to give him the however much it was, the $210 million.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And somebody else comes around and is like, this motherfucker's playing League of Legends while he's on the call. And they thought that was a good thing. That's incredible.
Yeah, it is. It's like, you know, if it were any other game or if it were like a lot of other things, I'd be like, yeah, good. Get your bag, you know, grift the fuck out of Sequoia Capital. But that should be taken as like one of the many red flags, right? This is someone that you are insistent has deeper insights into market structures, has deeper insights into how to use crypto, has deeper insights into morality, and so on and so forth. But time and time again, you see them acting cynically or uninterested in basic things that might altogether suggest they are using you for their own ends, and that they understand that the space is, you know, largely fraudulent or scam heavy, that they understand they have to put up a front or facade to get the money, and that they don't think, you know, they're beholden to anyone, that anything really matters once they get the money except, you know, enriching themselves and achieving whatever long-term ethical outcomes they want or think that are worth it, which, you know, is going to be enriching themselves and making sure humans can live in Nirvana on Jupiter or whatever.
Why Jupiter? It's Mars. It's always Mars, right?
If you want to dip into the sci-fi thing for a little bit, right? You know, Mars, of course, I think a lot of people are going to live there, right? But if you terraform it, if we're diving down the rabbit hole, right? Mars.
Oh, you have thoughts on this. You've thought about this.
Because I think the thing that these people want or talk about, and what a lot of the far-flung post-humans and transhumans talk about is, you know, migrating consciousness into electronic environment. So you, to do that, you got to convert something or have a large enough computational substrate to hold people's minds. And, you know, in a lot of sci-fi that I've read and enjoy, they use, what they usually end up doing is taking, you're doing some engineering of Jupiter, right? Maybe using the gas cloud or using the moons as material that they can reconstruct into a giant computer.
That's basically where you build the power plant, essentially, is Jupiter. Yeah, okay.
So that's why it always comes up in my mind, which just also makes it even more ridiculous, because it's like, you know, we've sent nothing there except like a probe that blew up. So,
All right, let's get back onto crypto, or else we're ended up talking about like, dude, it's going to get real bad. Where does this end for specifically him? And where do you see crypto in like the next 6 months?
Yeah, I think those are good questions. I think crypto, in a few important ways, I think crypto seems fucked to me, in the sense that, you know, Sam Bankman-Fried was probably one of the most trusted, if not the trusted, you know, face of crypto, right? This is a guy who didn't really have any notable scandals around him. Some question marks, but the question marks were constantly raised by the skeptics and critics, and so they might have been dismissed. And who was able to, even after describing like one of the core tenets of like the industry is a Ponzi scheme on a Bloomberg podcast, was still seen as a darling, right? This is someone who was good at speaking to regulators, good enough at speaking to politicians that he was able to, you know, get in good graces of a few. Probably at a point where he might have been able to catalyze like the sort of regulation that would have protected him if this happened after the fact, right? And that's all gone, right? So now that that's gone, of course, you know, that might chill venture capital interest, that might chill consumer interest. But I think also, like, you know, what like Joe Eisenthal was talking about at Bloomberg, right? Who are the institutions going to deal with? Are they gonna deal with Binance? I mean, Binance right now is being investigated for money laundering for criminal cartels across the world, and for various governments. I don't think crypto already has a reputational risk, as he talks about. Crypto already has some scandals and some fraud that keeps happening that you have to bake into the calculations of risk in investing in it. And now the guy who was supposed to be, you know, the white knight, who was supposed to be saving all these crypto platforms and firms, is revealed to have been a fraud himself, or engaged in a serious amount of fraud that might see him in, you know, in jail, or facing criminal prosecution at least. Who's left? Like, who do you go to after that? Who has the money and the size and the clean enough reputation? I mean, like, the only other ones, the only other large enough figures might be what? Coinbase and Brian Armstrong, but even then there's, you know, contention there in the history. Binance again, and CG, no. You could go to some of the Bitcoin maxis, no. you're not gonna make Michael Saylor the face of crypto respectability. So it's a limited number of options. So I think, like, you know, as you was talking about there, that might be one reason why institutions start to lose interest. And if institutions start to lose interest, I mean, institutions are trying to drive some of the more esoteric and creative justification of Bitcoin, you know, by creating some of the exchanges or, you know, the financial instruments and ways to speculate on it, right? Trying to figure out ways to expose pension funds and endowments to crypto, right? With that gone, you're gonna see that money pull back, right? And if that money pulls back, that's a huge amount of capital in an already illiquid ecosystem. Not really sure what happens, right? I feel like there will just be the only thing that I think is sure is that there would be a contagion and that you'll see a few more places collapse and crash. How far and wide that goes, no idea. But I do think that this is a pretty seismic thing, and there are going to be some scalps or heads, you know, cut off for this, because this is nearing $10 billion that disappeared from a place that was offering merely $1 billion to other platforms in terms of lifelines, and all of that is gone now.
What do you think happens to Bankman-Fried?
There are a lot of scenarios, you know. One is that nothing, or a slap on the wrist, and he just, like, you know, stays outside the U.S. maybe, or comes back and, you know, gets a little VC investment and does some other company, just like Adam Friedman. Not Adam Friedman, Adam Newman, burned tens of billions of dollars of investor capital, made them all look like idiots, and is now being bankrolled by A16Z to do a carbon coin and a way to turn your apartment complex into WeWork again.
Oh, good. You know, so
that's one option. Another is that financial regulators go hard after him and make an example out of him, mount his skull on a mantle. And I think that increasingly is becoming a possibility just because of how bad the things we are finding out about what the fraud was looking like are, you know. I had thought the possibility is kind of remote, but after finding out about backdoors that he had installed in the company, after looking at the balance sheet, you know, after starting to also see that now other exchanges that were also for, you know, pointing towards traders and hedge funds are going insolvent, I feel like there's going to be a lot of people who, you know, are going to want pound for pound of flesh from him.
Pound of flesh, I think, and skulls mounted on mantles, I think, is a beautiful place to end this conversation. Edward Anguiso Jr., thank you so much for coming on to Cyber and walking us through this.
Of course, thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. That's all for this episode. We're going to be talking to Aaron Gordon, believe, tomorrow. And if you want to catch that live, you go to youtube.com/motherboard or twitch.tv/motherboardtv and follow us there. You'll be notified when we go live. And of course, you can always catch it as a podcast later. But it's more fun with the audience interaction. Really some good chat today in there. Maybe some things I can't say out loud, but it was a good chat. And hey, you can go back and read it at twitch.tv/motherboardtv. And we'll see y'all in the future. Goodbye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.